Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists come to share their most recent work. I'm Angie, and for this week's episode, I am excited to chat with Dr. Brian Brown. Brian is a professor of teacher education at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford University. His research interest explores the relationship between student identity, discourse, classroom culture, and academic achievement in science education. In this episode, we chat about his recent work on adopting VR, virtual reality, in the classroom. The title of the paper we discuss is Teaching Culturally Relevant Science in Virtual Reality. Quote, when a problem comes, you can solve it with science. Brian shares his insights on how VR could be a valuable tool to science education. He also talks about how he became interested in this topic at the first place. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I am so excited to talk to you and chat about science education. So this summer, I happened to be interning at a nonprofit that tries to bring science education to more children. And I was able to see a lot of the disparity in science education, even in areas as affluent as where we are in the Bay Area. So when I read about your expertise, I feel like I needed to talk to you. So here we are. Today, the paper we are going to start our conversation with is this one titled Teaching Culturally Relevant Science in Virtual Reality. Quote, when a problem comes, you can solve it with science, end quote. And I have to say, this is such an intriguing title. And I wonder if you can start by just talk a little bit about why VR, other than this is such a cool technology that started to emerge in recent years.
Sure. So first, let me say thank you for inviting me to this conversation. I'm looking forward to sharing. And so I guess the place to start is to think about the actual technology itself, because the article you are referring to is not solely about the technology, but how we might use the technology to transcend teaching. And so the first thing I want to point towards is that as recently as last year, studies have indicated that students have cell phones, high school students in particular, show up with smartphones at a rate of about 84 to 85%. So let me kind of explain why that's significant to us. There's something really fascinating about cell phones. We don't like to throw them away, right? We upgrade, but we definitely don't like to throw them away. So that means parents are buying cell phones and then handing those cell phones to their children. So as we started to think about it, that meant that the technology is fairly extraordinary in these cell phones. And so I think for us, it becomes so invisible. We're so deeply engrossed in the technology that we miss it. So for example, we knew that these cell phones are capable of hosting AR, or augmented reality software. Generally, they have accelerometers. And so they're able to function as virtual reality machines, as long as we provided these simple $3 cardboard VR boxes. So for us, that was an amazing place to start, to say every student walks into a classroom, not every student, but the majority of modern students are going to walk into the classroom with a device that is capable of hosting virtual reality. So then the question is, what kind of virtual reality? And so this goes back to the previous point, right? It's not about the technology, it's about how we might teach. So in most cases, what you do with a virtual reality experience is you embed a student in a location that they can never see in other contexts. Mm-hmm. And while that's super interesting, if you tell me that science is happening everywhere else except for my environment, then what are you saying about my environment? Mm-hmm. So if I take you to see kind of a far off chemical reaction in some incredibly interesting place, then it makes the chemistry that's happening outside my door invisible and not interesting. So we had a thought, and that thought was, what if we can take you right outside of your door, your local environment, and show you the biology and the chemistry and physics in your environment? So the virtual reality enables you to put on goggles, mm-hmm. to go through the environment. We can overlay things. So for example, mm-hmm. we can see carbon emissions coming out of cars, mm-hmm. or we can, you know, do an animation. So we can take you into a local area and show you the biodiversity and show you how invasive species have shown up where originally there were other species, mm-hmm. there. So what that does, and I've gone a long way to get to this point, is the next time when you take those goggles off, you walk outside your room, you go inside, now the science is vividly clear. Mm. You see it differently. That's the power of what we were hoping to accomplish.
Right. So it sounds like it's almost like once you show the kid that the science is there, they will be able to see it more easily next time, even without the help of VR. So in some way, it's almost like the VR is playing a scaffolding role. Is that a characterization of what the idea is?
Well said. And I would argue that because of the microscopic nature of science phenomena, you always have to represent it in some fashion. Right. And so traditionally, we show videos and we're showing animations, but those are always decontextualized. They never show you the science of the grocery store that you're walking into, the science of the liquor store that you're walking into. And so what we wanted to do is localize those phenomena.
Right. Got it. So how did you bring these technologies to the students? So I know that it sounds like in this paper, you brought these technologies to almost 100 elementary students. So I'm curious about the kind of the nuts and bolts of how this study is being conducted. Are those children's the ones with previous experiences with VR? And I also wonder if it is something that's comfortable for them that they would willingly do on their own, even with outside of the classroom context.
Sure. So great question. And so the first thing I want to say is that very few of those students had virtual reality experience. And those who did, it was always in the context of gameplay. Hmm. So part of what we were trying to do is we wanted the equality of the technology to make sure it's consistent. So we brought in cell phones and wireless hubs. Mm-hmm. And so we would show up a box of cell phones, pass them out to students. And the day one was just familiarity with learning how to use VR. And so for all of the students, we would do traditional stuff, take them on a roller coaster. And the next VR experience, they would go to a zoo and be able to see chimpanzees up close. And so the initial aspect of the study was developing familiarity with the software and the mm-hmm. phones. And so we did that. Then the second phase is then we had a control and treatment group. And so our two conditions were a little bit different. We had culturally relevant VR, meaning we took them to places that they would see normally. Mm-hmm. And then we had there's no such thing as irrelevant, culturally distant. And so we took them to where we did the study in California. So we took them to Snowtop Mountains. We used a British voiceover, classical music versus our experimental condition, which was hip hop music in their local environment, a student who spoke like they spoke, just to give them a sense of familiarity. So we try to create equity in technology to make sure everyone's comfortable. And then we had two different conditions. And we did a randomized controlled experiment. So students could be right next to each other with different conditions.
I see. So I think you're already hinting at my next question, which is the framework that's being adopted in this research, culturally relevant pedagogy. And I'm wondering if you can briefly introduce what it is and what's the background, the theoretical background of this framework, and why is it important?
Sure. So I think there's a misnomer around culturally relevant pedagogy, mm-hmm. and the mistake is that we assume it's not a learning theory. Mm-hmm. So if you were to read the handbook of learning, and these are psychological studies, two things really stand out. The first is explanatory power. If I have to articulate and explain it, I'll understand it. And this is the self-explanation effect. The second is situated learning, meaning this: I learn the things that I need to learn because they're a necessity of my experience. Mm-hmm. For example, I always use the example, carpenters are phenomenal at measurement. Carpenters can measure fractions like no other because building the chair, framing the door requires the act of adding fractions. As a learning theory, what you want to do is create situations that require you to learn. So we don't think of that as culturally relevant, but it is, right? It is the culture of my experience is where I learn the things that are most relevant to me. So when a teacher walks into the room and says, well, today I'm going to teach you about chemical bonding, that may have no cultural relevance to the kids because right. they've never framed it in a way where students' expertise matters. Mm-hmm. What if I said to the student, well, you know, when you go to a shower and it's humid, why is it that if you have curly hair, it causes your hair to get frizzy? Or why would it impact your hair at all? Now what I've done is taken a cultural environment, which is a shower, and I've added the context of hydrogen bonding to their lived experience. And so it's culturally relevant and it's situated. So our argument is that if I give you two layers of this cultural relevance, number one, I'm going to put it in the context that you're familiar with, then you're more likely to learn it, right? And then the second is to send these subtle cues of cultural belonging, right? Learning is not purely cognitive. It is psychological. It is social. And so I want them to know that they can do it by embedding subtle cues. And so the music is the music that they listen to. The voices are the voices that they might hear at home. And so with those two things, we're trying to maximize the learning experience across contexts. And so in our particular study, we had a culturally irrelevant, kind of a very distant place, literally, physically and culturally, in a very local environment, culturally and physically.
Right. Thank you so much for laying this out. I do not have much background in education, so this is the first time I'm learning about this framework, and it definitely gives me a lot of insights into my own learning. And if we can pause at this concept a little bit, I do want to ask, so for example, I'm thinking about different domains, and as the students became more advanced in their studies, necessarily a lot of the concept would become more abstract. So for example, math, you mentioned that the idea was carpenters, so they are like measuring fractions, so that's why they do it well. But then when you come to like more advanced level of mathematics, such as linear algebras, I'm not entirely sure what are the proportions of people on Earth who do linear algebra every single day. And I'm just curious if there's other kind of a set of cultural practices or contexts that are relevant to even more abstract ideas that I'm just not aware of, or is there a kind of a different set of practices that are often adopted to facilitate learnings when the concept become more and more abstract?
Absolutely. So I don't have the whole hour to get to it, but of course, every scientific principle is driven by some question, right? Whether abstract or specifically phenomenological, I can see it and touch it, right? And so everything from theories of relativity to whether or not I can go down a hill faster based on the shape of the object or the weight of the object. Both of those particular ideas, very practical, very abstract, are driven through context. And so what we wanted to do early on in students' experience is provide them with a depth of experience and understanding that will transcend, because learning is not just cognitive. So here's what I want to argue. If early on a student learns science in the context of their experience, we're building confidence. They know that science is important. They know that people like me do science. Mm-hmm. So as you get to higher levels of scientific reasoning that are complicated, then you have the confidence to perform. And this is where psychology comes into play. In your field, there's a lot of work about working memory capacity and what hinders working memory capacity. Some of my favorite studies in educational psychology, like from Claude Steele or Nalani Ambati, when they really are able to isolate how having doubt takes up a person's working memory capacity and then limits their learning, right? So if you can produce doubt, and this is where I think it's been powerfully shown in psychological studies, can you produce confidence? Mm-hmm. Right. And so you can embed cues of belonging and cues of connectedness. And so let me give you an example. If I'm in a advanced level chemistry class, I walk into the class and I'm the only person of color in that classroom. I want you to envision two different versions. In one class, I'm by myself. It is difficult because it's poorly taught. The teacher is teaching with complex language. They're not explaining the idea very clearly. And I am having a hard time. Condition A. Condition B, same terrible teaching, but next to me is a person who is of a similar context and they're affirming, I can do this or we can do this, right? The teacher is saying, well, this is difficult, but we'll thrive in this environment, right? So what happens? Literally in both those situations, the person who has social support is operating from a different paradigm. They don't have the psychological stress, and it's no reason, I mean, it's no surprise then the institutions that are, for example, women perform better when they're at all women's institutions because you remove those social barriers, right? African-American students thrive in historically Black colleges and students in science in those same environments. So I'm getting a long way to get to this point. But in these learning equations, it's not just can you understand, but it's also psychological. Like, am I experiencing doubt in an overloaded working memory because I have to think about the things of belonging and social connectedness? And so to our point, if we really want to master learning, one, we want to make sure people know that they belong, and two, that they understand the content. So here's a simple example. In sports, performance is one metric, but they also invest in sports psychologists to create an environment of healthy thinking around how they will perform. In science, we have an extraordinarily skewed paradigm where we say, if you didn't learn it, you're just not smart enough. Not that we don't teach it well. Not that we created excessive psychological stress because we overcomplicated it, right? And so the scenario is really, really dynamic. And so going back to the original question, if you get into complex or higher end science, my argument is it's going to be difficult for anyone, but we want to create the psychological and linguistic supports to really help students thrive.
Right. I really appreciate this really thoughtful and detailed answer. And now I really see the values of VR, which is kind of bringing the context to the students instead of expecting them to strive or to find the context. So maybe this is a nice segue to take a deep dive into the research. So this is a qualitative research. And I know in this paper, you laid out two themes. One is learning science through VR gave a novel view. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that. What is that theme? What is the most exciting finding you have from this first theme that you summarized?
Sure. So I want to say that this is one of the four manuscripts. In the other manuscript, qualitative, where we study learning outcomes, and we have mixed results, right? So trial one, really strong statistical significance. We celebrated. We're excited. Trial two, they broke even. Trial three, it was the opposite. So we really had the ultimate null result, which we would think is a lot has to do with the design. Now, with the manuscripts I shared with you, mm-hmm. one of the things that we were really struck by was how students transferred what they knew to the environment they lived in. And so let me give you an example. So they were learning about healthy food options. They were learning about how their local grocery stores and environments did not provide fresh produce, or they were learning about producers and consumers and decomposers. And it gave them, you know, an objective number one is that they understand the differences between trophic levels and energy production systems. They all could articulate it. The students in the control group didn't make the leap in the same way to broader social issues the way that the students in the control group did. And so here's what I'm arguing. They started talking about how, well, if you go to a local store, if people want to be healthy, we should have low-cost, affordable fruits and vegetables as opposed to processed foods. Because when we took them into the grocery store to look for produce and fresh fruits, they couldn't find them. And so in educational psychology, that is called transfer. It's when an idea is valuable in one context, and then you shift it to another context, and it has explanatory power. So the first pattern of result was that these are fifth graders. Fifth graders talked about economic justice and how the science of trophic levels, where we get the most efficient energy level from eating fresh fruits and vegetables, meant that we should have those foods readily available in their communities. They talked about the lack of grocery stores. They talked about the cost of items. And that was a powerful application of the science that they were learning, simply because they put on VR goggles and were able to travel through their own neighborhood.
Oh, that's amazing. So I know one of the focus or emphasized in this theme in the paper you elaborated on is how it gives students a novel view. So I'm wondering, to what extent this is something that's uniquely VR? So I know that VR has this ability to lay on top of the environment. But say a student without much experiences working with things like a tablet or even a smartphone would... the ability to just to look at their informations on their phone in real time, would that be like still something similarly effective? So I guess my question is, what's uniquely special about VR in terms of giving rise of this effect?
Sure. So there's a few things that are uniform in the literature. The first is engagement. And so a lot of what we found was that students who traditionally are not engaged in school or not interested, there was high levels of engagement. So a teacher could walk into the room and say, today we're going to learn about trophic levels and we're going to talk about food justice, right? They could do that without virtual reality. Mm-hmm. What they can't do is have students show up immersed in their neighborhood. So here's why engagement matters. So now when you put the goggles on, you're in your local grocery store or you're driving around your neighborhood, there's a lot of excitement. There's literally excitement because they're like, oh, I know this place. Huh. This is where my mom goes to get her clothes cleaned, or this is our favorite restaurant. And so that excitement is a layer of it, which then is connected to engagement. So then what are we having them see in these environments? We have them do the analysis. One of those analyses was identifying the growing number of DaVita dialysis centers in their local neighborhood, contrasted that to the availability of fruits and vegetables, right? So you can talk about it, but to actually see it is a striking and challenging physical experience, even though it's not an actual physical experience. And more importantly, when we go back out, it now plants a seed where I know what this, I know where this environment is. Now, I want you to think about it. If you're 12 years old, you have this new profound insight that we have unhealthy foods in our neighborhoods, that we don't have free fruits and or inexpensive fruits and vegetables, and there's a lack of grocery stores in our particular neighborhood. And there are a growing number of DaVita dialysis machines to treat people with diabetes right next to fast food restaurants. As a 12-year-old, when you get in the car and you're talking to grandma, what do you think is going to happen?
I am not going to feel very well. I'm going to ask grandma, what can I do?
That's it. And that is one of the things that was so striking. I'm going to explain it to grandma, and I'm going to think about what might we do to change this reality. And that is the power of learning in situation. It's what culturally relevant pedagogy is about. And it's a hard thing to do for any teacher. So for us to be able to create this through software, it just takes a little bit of burden off the teacher, gives them a really powerful tool to enable the students to see science differently.
Right. Since you mentioned the software, so I just want to ask more about it, because I'm curious about the makings of this culturally relevant software. Like, so did you just go into the school and ask the children where their neighborhoods are and then go through that? So how did you make sure? What are the ways that you can do to make sure that the teaching material is actually culturally relevant to these students?
That is the ultimate question, because what is culturally relevant for one environment is irrelevant for another, and we cannot make assumptions about it. So we have a group of schools that we tend to work with in the Northern California. And so we work with those teachers and ask them, can we give a pre-assessment? Mm-hmm. So the pre-assessment is a set of questions about concepts. So where might you learn? So some of our lessons were about food. And so we said, what is the food that you eat most often? And the number one on the list was Flaming Hot Cheetos. And so our lesson, that's actually now even a movie about Flaming Hot Cheetos now. Our lesson was designed around food health, but in the context of Flaming Hot Cheetos, right? That is specific to our learning environment. So the lesson was titled The Case of the Flaming Hot Cheetos. The second question was about biodiversity lesson. We wanted to know for these young people, where do you see lots of different types of animals? And we found out they love going to the Oakland Zoo. And so the second one was really situated in the Oakland Zoo. So for anybody designing instruction that is supposedly relevant for young people, it's important to go find out. And so we do pre-assessments. Once we did the pre-assessments, we went back and designed the virtual environment. So we went out with VR 360 cameras, videotaped context, went through their neighborhoods, and we built out the software.
Right. Did you have some chance to talk with the students afterwards about, do they really think these are things that are culturally relevant to them?
Absolutely. Well, part of the interview is asking them, well, what was meaningful? What did you see and why did it matter? Right. And so a lot of that was, a lot of the results were what I shared earlier, them saying, I'm happy to know that this is a problem, or that I didn't recognize that part of what was happening locally was that it is more difficult for us to get the kind of food that makes us healthy. And then it is easier for us to get medical treatment that costs a lot of money to treat something that could be solved by having access to healthy food. And it's such a powerful way to think about the world, and it's how we want our students to understand concepts. So that was how we thought about it.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that these young students are having such profound insights into not only about the scientific topics, but also the sociopolitical issues around those things, which is very, very impressive. And the other theme that I think lists out in this paper is about connections to self and beyond. Would you mind take us through what this theme is about?
Sure. So part of what we wanted to measure was this through survey, whether or not students saw themselves as scientists, whether or not engaging in this type of instruction enabled them to see themselves as scientists, and more importantly, whether or not it enabled them to see that science had a value in their lives. And that was also a very positive outcome, where students said, you know, and it's the title of the article, "What now when I see a problem, we can solve it with science." And so this goes back to your earlier question. When science is always abstracted, I'm going to teach you about a cell, I'm going to teach you about trophic levels, I'm going to teach you about chemical bonding, then there is no fundamental problem that the science solves in the lives of the kids. Well, one of the primary outcomes where students were saying, what I learned from this is that you can solve problems with science. So part of the value of the VR is to really show that relationship, and then you can center lessons around enabling students to see, here's how science is solving important problems that we are challenged with.
I see. So when I was reading this section, one of the questions that pops up in my head is about this idea that a lot of people, when critiquing about VR, it's always about how this technology is isolating, that you are literally sitting in a room staring at a very small screen and you can't see other people. And when you're interacting with people, even in virtual world, it's often very awkward because the limiting technology that we have. So I'm curious about how that squares in its implications to science educations, because I know science is intrinsically a social practice. It's a cultural practice where you need to interact with other scientists and you need to be acculturated to the cultural practices. And one of the challenges of VR, one is that it doesn't offer a lot of the social connections that, say, a laboratory setting will have. And the other thing is about, given the limited technology at the current time, you don't really have a lot of the opportunity to do embodied learning. Your hands are not actually on top of a piece of rock. You're not doing a lot of experiments on your own. So I'm wondering about your thoughts on these two common critiques about VR technology.
Absolutely. Well, first let me say that they are absolutely valid in meaningful ways, except the types of virtual reality you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So most of the virtual reality that is done are done by psychologists in lab contexts. There are very few in-classroom randomized control studies on virtual reality for a set of very valuable reasons. Number one, if I'm going to do that, I need 35 or 40 VR headsets that I need to bring to the classroom. Number two, and this is our biggest issue, they need to be functional on the wireless network. And currently, K through 12 classrooms do not have great wireless functionality. And that was our biggest limitation. And so our work is a little bit different, is that we wanted to make it cost efficient. So we were using cardboard VR boxes. And so they have clickers that are screen touches, but they're not great. And so the design task has to enable students to interact. And so, for example, when you go into your virtual environment, you have to identify particular things that are looking for producers, consumers, looking for food science, or looking for the types of food in their neighborhood. And then they come out of the virtual world and they're working in small groups, how to identify what are the possible outcomes, making sense of the science. And so the VR experience is not an hour. So I want to be clear is that all of the research suggests it has to be very short. And so these are 10 to 15 minute virtual visits that then led to engagement. And they actually did a regular science lab in the classroom itself. And so there was not a replacement for the lab, but a contextualization activity that enabled them to make sense of it. And so, yes, if you think of traditional virtual reality with headsets in isolating lab, yes, but this is absolutely not what we're doing. We were in classrooms. They work in VR independently. And then what they gain from that experience, they have to work on as a group.
I see. So it's not like this technology is replacing, but it's almost like augmenting their current learned experiences. So maybe I'm just going to be a little bit forward-looking a little bit. Let's imagine that all of those technical and practical constraints are all removed. Say that all of the K-12 education systems all have wonderful wireless network and headsets are working great and it's very cheap and you can just buy it like in random convenience stores. And the type of material you can create there is also like way better than what you can imagine. It takes way less time. So do you imagine one day with the technology improved, significantly improved and become more accessible, VR can play a more integral role and potentially replace these in-school education one day?
Never replace in-school education. So let me start there. The humanity of me as a teacher understanding the needs of my students is going to be the hardest thing to replicate. So all we're trying to do is provide better instructional tools. So here's where I think the benefit is. With the virtual reality instruction, you can go micro. So I can now provide a student microscopic understanding of the phenomenon. I can take them deep into a cell. I can take them into an atom and show them what chemical bonding looks like. The alternative is a video that is 2D. And what you lose is scale, you lose speed, and you lose the power of interaction. So I can and those in a virtual environment through animation is something really powerful. So that's micro. From a meso perspective, I can talk about phenomena, but I can show you that same phenomena. So what if I'm talking about climate change and we're talking about glacier movement? We put on goggles and now I'm in Alaska. I'm no longer in the abstract. I can gain some insight. And so there's a meso thing. I can really get a sense of location. And then there's a macro, right? I can say, okay, let's scale out. I want to give you a global map of carbon emissions across the world, put the goggles on. Now I can see the world. So the power of the digital tool is the presence can really give the people an understanding of scale across the macro, the meso, and the micro. And one thing I know about technology, it always gets better. So right now, the newest versions of virtual reality, virtual VR, you just put the goggles on and your hands are detected. So once that happens, then we can literally have hands-on low-cost VR. Right now, you can do it, but it's very expensive. So I am subtly optimistic, but to be absolutely clear, what I want to happen is that we use these tools to create better instructional opportunities for teachers that are cheap. Because one of the things we never mentioned, and I was a bio teacher, is every day I have to stock a lab. I have to load that lab up. It's very expensive. It is time intensive, and we can really support teachers that way. And because this is a psychology podcast, here's where I'm really excited. If we can do psychological harm by implanting doubt in students, by making them feel uncomfortable because they're the only person who's bilingual, imagine we can now have a multilingual VR experience and really give them affirmation. We can embed subtle cues of support and affirmation for students to build their confidence. The cultural framing, I'm going to mess you up. Now, here's where I'm going to mess you up. We have this peculiar thing in science where many of our voiceovers are British voiceovers in science. Well, it makes no sense, right? So we're messaging something very detrimental, that everything scientific is not of the culture of the young people. And so VR, because it has to be embedded in somebody's culture, can really flesh out and improve those things. So I'm optimistic about where we might head.
Right. That's fascinating. When you mentioned that a lot of voiceover are British, I can almost hear it in my head. Yes, this is exactly what it sounds like.
It's a strange thing. It is a very strange thing.
Right. Since we are already talking about this interaction between technology and education, so I wonder if you would be willing to share some of your thoughts in this like most recent trend of a lot of the generative AI. Like, I'm pretty sure you're aware, ChatGPT, Bard, all of those generative AI. And I can't help notice a lot of people, teachers or journalists, are speculating the implications of it towards science. Because on the one hand, it feels like those technologies are going to provide a lot of amazing opportunity for personalized feedback for the students, because one single teacher might not have the opportunity to, for example, provide one-on-one feedback to all the 40 students that they need to be responsible for. But on the other hand, there are also a lot of concerns about when you strip out the humanities part of this instruction or education, it's just going to not be the same. So I'm wondering if you have some thoughts in terms of how that's going to influence education or science education for that matter.
Certainly. So I've been reading quite a bit. I think I was quite struck by Brian Christensen's book, The Alignment Problem, which helped frame how part of what the programming process of, or the learning process of AI involves accessing all of the available data. Right. And then making and identifying patterns on what is available. And so as such, the questions you ask, you're really getting information back based on its assessment of you, which is problematic if the people who are doing the design work do not have dynamic cultural and gender understandings, because you're limiting access. So here's where I think there is potential. Instructional conversations are unique. And so when you show up in a chemistry class, or you show up in a biology class, the one thing we know you should not know is biology or chemistry. It's the teacher's job to get you there. A good teacher is not just going to ask you questions about biology and chemistry and hope that you answer them, right? That's not how good instructional conversations happen. A good instructional conversation, the teacher asks you your opinion, what your thoughts are, has you compare your ideas with your colleagues, have you go find out some information, do some research, do some experimentation, And then they'll step in to ask a right on time question. And then when you get to the limits of where you're starting to begin frustrated, then they'll say, here's one way to understand it. They'll offer that information. But the culture of that kind of conversation, these are instructional conversations. They have to be programmed. Teachers have to learn how to learn to communicate that way. The first thing that I learned as a teacher, you got to stop talking. You have to ask good questions, be a world-class listener. So if we can program artificial intelligence devices, whether it be a tablet or a cell phone or a laptop, to provide teachers with supportive, small group formative assessment conversations that reflect what we know about teacher talk, that can be amazing. Right now, that's not what happens. AI is designed to tell you what it believes the answer is, and it's often wrong. And so that will not support a teacher. However, I know that the goal is that every teacher ends up with 30 instructional assistants, meaning they will be in a room where now they have a second teacher. So it's going to require AI leaders to do something very different. They're going to have to listen to educators. And I think that's been a failure of computer science broadly. There are hundreds of years of incredible education research that is simply ignored. Now, education research is not what a lot of people think it is. It's extraordinarily interdisciplinary. There are psychologists, sociologists, economists, scientists such as myself. And so as a dynamic set of scholars exploring how learning works, they've got to dive deeper into what constitutes natural language processing. Because natural language processing for a teacher is not the same phenomenon as it would be for a conversation like we're having.
Thank you so much for sharing that insight. And when you are talking about how it's unique, I kept thinking about how there's a lot of news and a lot of conversations about how these large language model is very biased, because those are like where the data comes from. And I can imagine that when a student comes from the background that are not aligning with the training data, it's just not going to be receiving the appropriate feedback. So I really appreciate that insight. So before we wrap up this episode, I do want to ask you about your own journey into this topic. I know you mentioned that you were originally a science teacher, and then I know you also share some papers that focus more on the kind of the basic cognitive mechanisms of learning. And now this VR technology-focused interdisciplinary works on education. So I'm curious about, what's your journey into this research and what are your plans for the future?
Well, that's the most difficult question of the day, but I'll try to do it as concisely as possible. But I started as a science teacher in Southern California with a love for teaching. I think science is amazing in that at some point in instruction, you get to watch young people discover the wonder and amazement of science as they go from I don't know it to I think I understand to oh, I really, really, really understand it. It's an amazing thing. One of the things that I found when I was teaching, that there was a hurdle, and the hurdle had to do with the actual language of science instruction. And so in some cases, a biology class can have as many new science words as an introductory Spanish class, but we don't do anything about it. So a teacher might walk into the room and say, well, you know, inside of the nucleus is the nucleolus, and the nucleolus is responsible for producing ribosomes, and ribosomes produce protein, right? Now, for me, going back to this interdisciplinary notion of learning, it's cognitive, it is psychological, and it is social. So for many students, they're like, this doesn't make sense, just on a purely cognitive level. And on a social level, if they're to talk like the teacher talks, to say, well, you know, ribosomes unzip the DNA and the RNA is now going to be connected to transfer RNA. And then at the ribosome, we're going to build the parts that anticodons and codons are built together to build the amino acid pairs. They get looked at like they are aliens. Like this, what kind of language are you using? Now, the irony is that when we discover these scientific phenomena, we describe them regularly first, and then we name them second. But when we teach them, we make no affordance for the language learning, and then we assume the kids don't get it. I don't know of another discipline where we can say, but if they don't understand it, that's just their fault, as opposed to we're teaching it poorly because the language becomes a hurdle. And so I started studying how the complex nature of language produces a problem for student learning. And part of what we discovered through some studies, borrowing some psychological methods, using Stroop and Flanker measures was that it literally is reducing the cognitive capacity of the students. It takes up working memory. So the analogy I always use is what happens is it's like trying to parallel park a car and the music is really loud and you're trying to park, so you turn it down so you can focus. And so removing the science language is akin to turning that music down and makes it easier. And then we can teach the students that language. So idea first, language second is where I started. And then after doing about 10 years of research in that area, the question was, how can technology play this role to support what teachers already know about this relationship between social support, language support, and cognitive support for students?
Right. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing this journey. And I would like to thank you again for coming on the show. And I'm really looking forward to more of your work in the future. I can't wait when the Vision Pro became a really popular thing. Like, what are the amazing things it can do? Because now the teachers can see the students' eyes if they're wearing Vision Pro.
That's going to be super cool. And I'm curious to see how they flesh out some really powerful instructional experiences.
Thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear what you think of this episode or our podcast in general. Or if you have any other suggestion for future guests or topics for the podcast, you can click on the link to the survey attached in the show note or reach us at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Twitter at stanfordpsychpod. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere so more people can find us. Thank you so much.